Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exist to help people find their way back to God. This week, Pastor Tim begins our new series we're calling Song of Songs. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Tim.
And if I haven't met you, my name is Tim, and we're glad you're with us this morning. If you have a Bible, we're going to be in Song of Songs. So if you have a physical Bible, you open it in the middle, and you're going to be somewhere in Psalms, and then go to the right two books, and you'll find your way to Song of Songs. It's not terribly long, but we're going to spend a relatively terribly long time here. Song of Songs, chapter 1. Today, what I want to do is simply set the stage for a conversation we're going to have over the next 12 weeks. And we're calling this particular series Song of Songs, What a 3,000-Year-Old Erotic Love Poem Can Teach Us About, let me see if I can get this right, singleness, dating, relationships, love, marriage, sex, and God. I know, right? So it's a bit of a mouthful but it's kind of the most ridiculous title ever, and we kind of love it, don't we? It's kind of great. It feels fitting for the series because we're in many ways going to go for it in this series. As we've been working the last several months, and it's actually been quite a bit of work, and yet filled with laughter and joy as we've done this work. But as we've been doing the work, one of the things we've realized is in many ways, I think this may be the most practical sermon series that I've ever preached in many ways, because it's one of those that we need to be really practical, right? Like if there's any source of greater heartache and pain, is it not our romantic relationships throughout our lifetime? If there's any place where we experience more shame and more loneliness, is it not in our human relationships? And yet at the same time, if there's any place where we've experienced greater joy and we've laughed harder and been more ourselves and felt more vulnerable and had opportunities to truly feel really seen, it's probably the person sitting right next to you. That person knows you better than anyone else, and you can put up a front, and they literally know your dirty laundry, literally. And actually, I was at the opportunity yesterday to go. I love these opportunities. I was at the hospital visiting someone who's gone through a really, really tough season with some health, and a husband and wife, and we're just chatting with them about kind of that the most recent health thing, and I then saw there's like a pillow on that really uncomfortable bench in the hospital, and I just asked like, "Have you been sleeping here?" And she said, "Yeah, of course I've been sleeping here." And it's just a reminder. Those are like really holy moments for me to be reminded of the gift of human love and a marriage, and to know that someone loves you so much that they are going to walk through anything with you. And so we need this series to be practical because this is our deepest pain, our deepest shame, and this is our deepest hope and our deepest joy in the times we feel most alive. So we need this to be practical. At the same time, we love studying the Bible here, and we're going to do that. We have an agenda. There is an ancient book in our Bible that doesn't get a lot of airplay in churches, and we want to reclaim this book. We actually think this book is quite practical and quite helpful, it has gotten a stigma attached to it. We don't talk about that in church. So we want to talk about that in church. So with that being said, let's dive in. This is Song of Songs, verse 1. Solomon's Song of Songs. Let's pause here. That's a strong opener. Would you agree? Like, well played there, Solomon. Solomon begins the whole thing by saying, you know, other songs have been written, but I just wrote the song that it's the Song of Songs. Like, this is the song to end all songs. Now, that's a great first line, but the next line may be even stronger. So he's like 1-2 punch here. The next line comes from her, and she says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the young women love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers." Some of you are thinking, wow, this lady really wants to go on a coffee date. Like, you read it and you want to blush, right? Like, what are we reading? What is this? This feels really personal, and we're kind of opening up their personal thing. And what are we reading? What is this? Well, actually, we find out from the very first line, kind of the genre that we're in. The very first line says, Solomon's Song of Songs. That's really, really important as we're going to journey through this. My hope is by the end of 12 weeks, you will agree with me that this is really helpful stuff for our relationships. But that first line is really important. The very first thing we read is that this is a song. Or this is a love song, or you could say this is a love poem, because we don't have the music anymore. So this is a love poem. Now that's important to know because poetry is poetry. Poetry is intentionally not always the easiest or the clearest way to say something. Poetry is trying to go after something else. This is not how we talk, and you're going to see this as we read through this poem. This is not how we talk in normal life, right? I don't come home and say, "Oh Liza, oh Liza, wherefore art thou, Liza?" I say, "Liza, where are you?" Right? Like that's how we talk. But this is poetic language, and so we got to know that about this. And like any piece of poetry, there are lots of ways that this could be interpreted. Some of them, over the years, if I just can name this one, have been pretty wild and weird. Some people have interpreted this in some really stretch of the imagination kind of ways. But then there are other ways to interpret this that really are trying to ask the question, what was it that the original author was intending to say when he wrote this poem down? What was the original goal? And we're kind of told the original goal. He wants to write a great, great love song to the person he loves. That's the intention. And so there are lots of ways to read this. We're going to try to get at it. Like, what was the author's intent in writing this? Now, there are three characters you're going to meet in this poem. There's her, then there's him, and then there are her friends. So there's her, there's him, and then there are her friends. Now, in particular, as you're reading through it, you get the sense pretty early on that this is written from the perspective of an older couple looking back on their relationship, beginning with the things that first attracted them to one another. But it's an older couple looking back. So chapter one deals with desire and attraction. And so we'll really spend more time there next week and the following week, but we'll spend a couple of weeks on that. And then you get to chapter four, and chapter four is the wedding night. So it is what you think it is. It's the wedding night. We'll spend a couple of weeks on that. And then there's some marriage conflict early in their marriage. Early in their marriage, there's an incident they record, and then later, there's another incident. And it's a little different, but it's a similar kind of conflict. And of course, we're going to spend 3 or 4 weeks just kind of wrestling through that. And then the whole thing ends with some advice that an older couple gives to the generation that's behind them. And it's really beautiful advice. And so we'll spend at least a couple weeks on that. The whole thing, when you step back from it, is it's really good stuff. It's practical, it's personal, it's deep, it's challenging, it's highly challenging. And if we're honest, we may blush at this stuff, but apparently God doesn't. Apparently God actually cares about our human romantic love. Like, God actually seems to care, like the actual stuff. Like the things that we find desirable about someone else, God cares about that. God cares about the fights. Like, that's in here. God cares about those moments, and we'll bump into this moment, but he wasn't there for me the moment I needed him the most. I gave my heart to this person, and he wasn't there for me in the moment I needed her most. Or, from his perspective, and this is in there too, it was a hard day at work, and I felt disrespected by everyone, and I came home, and I just needed her to respect me. I needed her to acknowledge it. And for her, at least, if she would have just said, "I respect you," it would have changed the game, but she didn't. Where was she? This is in there. How do I know that this is the right one? Or how do I know that this is the person I can commit my life to? That's in there. Or what do I do with all the physical urges? Like, all of that. What do I do with that desire? Because it's like an energy source inside of me. Where do I go with that energy source? Or what do you do when you made a promise to yourself? Maybe even a promise to God, and then you broke that promise. What do I do with that? Where do we go with that? This song addresses all of that. Now, a couple disclaimers before we dive into the series. First one is this song is about relationships, not just sex. Okay, so we hear this as we were saying, hey, we're gonna do Song of Songs. Like, really? 12 weeks on that? Okay, so it's about relationships, not just like physical intimacy. We will address that pretty head on in weeks 5 and 6. And so we'll kind of give a warning for those of you who have littler ears with you. That'll be the PG-13, maybe rated R weeks. The majority of the book is about relationships, not just that. So second disclaimer, some of you are single. And maybe you're thinking right now, like, so we're gonna do 12 weeks on a topic that has no relevance to me. I feel that. We felt that as we were working through this stuff. Some of you are single and you want to get married someday. There's a lot here for you. But then there's others of you who are single and you're single and you were with someone and that ended either through death or divorce. Others are single and like, no, this is the path I'm on. I don't intend to get married. And it would be the temptation to check out. Honestly, like the temptation would be to say, like, this isn't about me. Please don't. Actually, let me say this. I think on behalf of the church, we owe you an apology. The church has often treated single people as an afterthought, from all the way down from our programming to how we talk from a stage to even the questions we ask, like, hey, when are you going to get married? That can hurt if God's called you to a life of singleness. That can hurt. We can treat sometimes in our culture and even in the church, or maybe even especially in the church culture, we can treat single people as an afterthought or as a little bit less or broken. And if that has been the way you've received this messaging, I am deeply sorry. It's not true. Of course it's not true. Jesus was single. The Apostle Paul, who writes the majority of our New Testament, Paul was single. Not only were they single, Paul will go on a rant celebrating being single. His whole shtick in the rant is that, hey, me being single allows me to give even more fully to the mission that God has me on. It's 1 Corinthians 7, if you're interested. It's like an epic rant. So if that's you, I promise you there is always like the issue, then there's the issues under the issue, and we're working really hard in the series to get at that issue, and that issue under the issue applies to all of us. So that's third disclaimer, or second disclaimer. Third disclaimer, if you couldn't tell from the first couple verses, Song of Songs doesn't shy away from the honest and, I would argue, healthy desires. It doesn't shy away from it. Again, we may blush, but what you're going to see is that the song just isn't going to blush. It is such sensual language, this song, that the rabbis, the Jewish rabbis, even said, some of them, said that anyone under 30 should not be permitted to read it. So those of you under 30, they said, oh, why 30? Well, you know, the priests were not allowed to serve, according to the book of Numbers, until the age of 30. And Joseph, he didn't really go into power until the age of 30. And David really didn't go into power until the age of 30. And then later, Jesus didn't really begin his public ministry to the age of 30. So they said, 30 is the age that you could read this and not giggle. That's what they said. It's the age of maturity. That's the age. And yet there's that like middle schooler living inside all of us that still wants to giggle at some of this. I get it. So just know that this is like, yeah, this requires a bit of maturity. And I say that to myself too. It requires a bit of maturity. Some of you are thinking, for the first time, I'm inspired to read my Bible. Yeah. What is in there? Fourth disclaimer, as our title suggests, this is erotic poetry. I say that, but it's really important to parse this. It is erotic, but it is not pornographic. Those are different. They're different. Erotic is good. It's healthy. It's how it's to be celebrated. It's how God designed us. Pornographic is like the flip, dark, ugly side of that. Pornographic is more what's in it for me, and we are willing to use other people for our own pleasure or whatever, our own desire, and we are willing to commodify people, and we are willing to objectify people, and that's pornographic. erotic and pornographic are not the same thing. And it's important that we remember that as we go through here. Our culture has so lost this that it's easy for our brains to lump those together because we have so seen any conversation like this as simply, ooh. But that's not actually true. So, but it is kind of how we tend to think about it. Now, when it comes to culture in spaces like this, would you agree that the idea of love, this is what we posted on social media, if you caught it, this idea of love, what it is, how to find it, when it comes to the culture around us, would you agree that we are a bit obsessed with this conversation, right? Here's the joke. Did you hear Taylor Swift got engaged? Why do we all know that? Really, seriously, why? And why do we all care? Why is that everywhere? Or just turn on your TV. Have you not noticed that when you turn on your TV, there's a lot of dating shows? And some of you, this may date you, but if you go back, they actually kind of began somewhat tame. Again, some of you may remember. Do you remember the show The Dating Game? As if that brings you back. Yeah, that's how people dress on dating shows now. Or the Newlywed Game. Remember the Newlywed Game? Who here remembers the one of these two shows? Like when they actually aired? That'll thin it out a little bit more. Okay. Now, these were very popular back in their day, but I don't know that anyone would have predicted just how big this particular industry would get. It's actually really hard to not watch dating shows if you watch TV. It's really the only thing on at some point. Like it's like this is what Netflix has to offer. Confession. This isn't a bad confession, but how many of you have gotten sucked in at one time or another into a show called The Bachelor? Okay, a lot of you. Yeah, a lot of us. I don't know. I was just Googling this week, is just working on like this piece of the sermon, and realized how many spinoffs there have been about The Bachelor. The Bachelorette, of course, you got to have the female side of it, and then you've got The Bachelor Pad. Some of you remember The Bachelor Pad, or The Bachelor in Paradise. Now we're going to move the Bachelors into a new location. We have the Bachelor Winter Games. That was the Olympic version of the Bachelor. Or this is a good one. I've not seen this one, but I like the concept. This is called The Bachelor Presents Listen to Your Heart, which is The Bachelor, but also apparently American Idol. There's that if you're into it. Then there's the Golden Bachelor. This is a new one because old people deserve love too. I think that's actually the concept of the show. Then, of course, if you got the Golden Bachelor, you need the Golden Bachelorette. Then there's all of the different country spinoffs, and every country's got their spinoffs. There's the Canadian version of The Bachelor, which I assume is the same as the American version, only it's a boot time to hand root that rose. Right? Like, very, very similar. And then there's the UK version of The Bachelor, which is instead of flirting, they banter. But otherwise, I'm assuming it's the same thing. And the list goes on and on and on and on, show after show after show. And that is just a tip of the iceberg, if we're honest. Here's a couple. There's Love Island. Then there's Temptation Island. Then there's Virgin Island. And then there's Singles Inferno, which takes place on a, wait for it, island. Yeah, I know, like, at some point, can we be more creative? Maybe we should just turn the keys over to AI and say, you create stuff for us. There is Date a Farmer, Date a Millionaire, Date My Mom. That's a real show. It's apparently out there. Then there's a show that's like all the rage right now. You've heard of this particular show. This show is called Love is Blind. You've heard of this? Yeah, there's like 70 spinoffs of this as well. Now, the premise of Love is Blind is we're going to put people in rooms, we'll call them pods, and they have to fall in love and get engaged before seeing each other, because love is blind. Then, on the other side, I just learned about this show as I was looking stuff up, and it apparently is one of the most popular dating shows in the UK. It's called Naked Attraction, and the premise is wild. We put them in a pod, and then but you're not allowed to talk to them. You have to decide whether you're going to date them based purely off of their naked body. That's the show. Because love apparently isn't blind at all. We keep going on. There's this show after show. Some of you are thinking, you didn't name my favorite one. Love on the Conveyor Belt or Too Hot to Handle or whatever they are. Here's my point. Can we agree that when it comes to dating and love and marriage and sex, our culture has a lot to say? And can we also agree that when you look at that conversation from a purely objective standpoint, standing at a distance, can we agree that though we have a lot to say, we also, it's pretty clear, we don't have any clue what we're talking about? Like, we're all just kind of confusing. Is it blind? Is it not blind? Is it on an island? Is it in a room? No wonder why right now, if you just look at the statistics, divorce rates seem to be through the roof and infidelity rates seem to be through the roof. Young people more than ever are reporting just all kinds of confusion around this stuff. So you would think that the church would be willing to step in. We actually have things to say, right? Like the church would. And yet when you just look at how the church has handled this, we simply don't. We don't talk about it. As if our romantic interests are not interesting or worthy of God's attention. But here's the thing. When you look at the scriptures, our Bible, the Bible actually has a lot to say. And maybe the most profound place it sits is in a little book called The Song of Songs, about love and singleness and dating and marriage and all of it. And honestly, it's really, really good stuff. We'll dive more into the heart of Song of Songs next week, but in the few minutes we have remaining, I want to give you a frame that I think may be helpful when sorting through all this. It's a frame we're going to come back to again and again throughout the series. Genesis 1 and 2, God creates the world, right? Light and dark and sun and moon and plants and animals. And then on day 6, God at the like height of the creation, God creates humans. And when God creates you and I, this is how that incident is described. Genesis 2, verse 7. Then the Lord God formed a man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And the man became a living being. In Genesis, we are told that we are dirt and we are breath. In Genesis, we're told that we're matter or material, but we are also infused with the spirit of our God. That's what it means to be a human. But then along comes Genesis 3 and a snake or a serpent. And that snake meets Adam and Eve. And this is the nature of the temptation. It's Adam, Eve, you want the fruit, don't you? You know you do. It's good fruit. You should have the fruit. Oh, you can't. God told you you can't have it. But didn't God give you the desire for the fruit? And come on. You can have the fruit. You've got wants. You've got needs. You deserve it. Who else is going to eat it? Like, God made you to want the fruit. You should have the fruit. Because Adam and Eve, you are just animals like me, right? That's the nature of the temptation. And let's be honest, that's a lie of the culture. That is our lie, that we are just animals. You have needs, you have wants, you have desires, you have cravings. It's just in your biology, we say. We are just animals. It's our biology. That is how culture, our world around us tends to act, right? This is how we tend to talk about it. Right? Huh? Buy me some time. My dog loves to sniff other dogs' butts. I discovered this the other day. We were at Labor Day, and the neighbors got a new dog, and the new dog came over, and they just did this circle thing, and they sniffed each other, and that's a weird sentence to say out loud in a church, but it's true, and I cannot judge my dog. He's a dog. This is what dogs do. This is their Snapchat. This is what they do, and I cannot judge my dog for doing what dogs do. You start doing that, that's weird. A couple of years ago, we went with the Cruz family to spring break down in Fort Myers Beach, and it was one of the days toward the end of the trip when we decided we're going to get a boat. So we got a boat, and my kids were little, and so we wanted to find the dolphins. And you ever get a boat and just kind of cruise through the channels looking for dolphins? And then we found two dolphins, and the two dolphins were swimming right up against our boat. And my little girl said to me, "Daddy, there's two of them. They're right by us." And then my little girl said to me, "Daddy, they stuck together." Yeah, can't blame the dolphins. They didn't care that I had my kids on spring break. They're just dolphins. They're just animals. Animals have a desire. They act on the desire. There's no pause button. There's no, well, let's make sure we have a financial under, like there's no, let's create a 10-year plan. It's just animals doing what animals do. And the dominant cultural message that you and I swim in is you're just an animal. When I was a kid, there was a show that was really popular. I was not allowed to watch this channel, and yet I did, right? Like, and the channel was MTV, and the show was MTV Spring Break. Anyone else want to confess to having memories of this show imprinted on your teenage imaginations? MTV Spring Break, it took place in all these different beaches. Cocoa Beach, Daytona Beach, probably Fort Myers Beach, like all these different beaches, down, typically Florida or Mexico. And it was college spring break students, head down, and it's just turn the cameras on, and every episode is the same. Every episode is the same. It is oiled up bodies, like big muscle guys showing off their abs, and girls in really thin bikinis. That's every single episode. And then years later, I get married and I have kids, and I take the kids to John Ball Park Zoo, and I was taking them to the chimpanzee exhibit. It's the same episode. They didn't get the message. But that is the message we get, right? Like, you're just a less hairy animal. You have needs. You have wants. You have desires. It is God who made you, after all. So blame him. You're just an animal. That's exactly the lie of the serpent in Genesis chapter 3. You're no different than me, Adam and Eve. You're no different than me. You see it, you want it, you take it. That's an animal. You're just an animal. But that's not where our Bible begins. Our Bible says you're human, and humans can actually say no. You have desire, and you can actually choose to not engage on every desire. Because you, yes, you are made of dirt, matter, material, but you also have the breath of God in you. This is one of the harshest critiques of the earliest Christians. They walk into cities, and they see other people claiming Jesus, and they see the way they're living. And the harshest critique that they'll give them is you're just living like an animal. This is Peter in Second Peter 2. He says, these people blaspheme in matters they don't understand. They're like unreasoning animals, creatures of instinct, born only to be caught and destroyed, and like animals, they too will perish. That's harsh. In other words, we're not animals. We don't have to live purely off of instinct. In Corinth, Paul will go to a city in Greece, and it's called Corinth, and there's a saying in the city of Corinth. The particular saying in the city of Corinth is food for the stomach and the stomach for food. It was their way of saying, we have urges, just like our stomach, we have an appetite, and we need to fill our appetite. The way we say it is YOLO, or whatever the kids say nowadays. Like, you only live once, so like, why else would God give you those needs or desires or urges or wants? Paul pushes back on them. Notice what Paul says. He says, you say food for the stomach and the stomach for food, and God will destroy them both. The body, however, is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. His argument is, you're not just an animal. Like, this body you were given, the lie is that you're just an animal. It doesn't affect you. It doesn't impact you. But you have the Spirit of God in you, and it imprints itself, those actions. All those dating shows, what are the messages? We are just animals. We are just animals. And it is a lie, and it should be called out by the Christian church as a lie. And on the other side, there's another lie, and this other lie has done, I don't know if it's equal damage, but it's significant damage. On the other side of the aisle, we have the what many of us were told, which is, here's the lie, just be more spiritual, right? You heard that phrase, especially in church circles, just be more spiritual, be more spiritual. Do you know that word spiritual is not in our Old Testament? There is no Hebrew word for spiritual. The Greeks created the concept that the body and the spirit were separate. So it is in our New Testament, but almost every time it's brought up in the New Testament is to react against it. Just be more spiritual. Here's the problem. You can't just be more spiritual. because you are not an angel. You're not an animal, but you're also not an angel. The way angels are described, Jesus in Matthew 22 describes an angel as being all spirit, no body. In the book of Hebrews, we read Hebrews 1, are not all angels ministering spirits sent to serve those who inherit salvation? That's you. But you are not an angel. You have a body. God made that body. God did give those desires, and God did call them good. And your spirit and your body, our spirit and our body, they're connected. But is that how the church has talked about this? That's either we don't talk about this, or you really shouldn't think about this. You gave your life to Jesus. You just do more spiritual things now. You shouldn't have those desires. You're just be like an angel. It's really funny when you go back to the earliest church, one of the things you discover is they talked a lot about this. Actually, one of the things I've heard the most since we said, we're going to do a series on Song of Songs, people have said, really? In church? It is a book of the Bible. Really in church. But actually, did you know that this particular book of the Bible, up until the 14th century, was the most preached on book in our Bible? Seriously. There's one guy by the name of Bernard of Clairvaux who preached 86 sermons just on the first two chapters of Song of Songs. 86. He would have finished, but he died first. Otherwise, he would have kept going. And it's not just the Christian church. Rabbi Akiba, so our Jewish friends, he says this. He's legendary. He says, all the writings are holy, but the Song of Songs is the holy of holies. So why don't we talk about it anymore? Well, there's an answer. His particular name of the gentleman is Girolamo Savonarola. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. Girolamo Savonarola. He said, Song of Songs, I've read it. We should remove it from our Bible. It's impure. It's immodest. People shouldn't read it. He also got rid of a bunch of art. He had a great bonfire where you were to bring anything that might, perfume, art, anything. And now he failed at getting it out of the Bible, but where he succeeded was he effectively made this whole book become taboo. And so we don't read it, or we simply answer it away. This happens a lot. We get quite creative with answering it away. Chapter 4, Song of Songs, wedding night. And you read the language from him, and this is his bride. They just got married, and he's praising her from head to foot. It's like, your hair is like this, and your eyes are like this, and your nose is like this, and your mouth is like this. Your neck is like the Tower of David. And he works his way down, and then he says, your breasts are like two fawns. I was talking to a friend, and he said, yeah, he was at a church, and the pastor was preaching on this passage, and he said, he came to your breasts are like two fawns, and he said, the left breast is the Old Testament, and the right breast is the New Testament, and between them is the cross of Jesus. Now, two thoughts. Number one, that's weird. I don't care how else you want to talk about the cross. That's a weird way to talk about the cross. That's weird. Number two, why do we feel the need to do that? Right? This is a husband and wife on their wedding night. Like, why do we feel the need to do that? And why, like, does it feel like it's the author's intent? I don't think it's the author's intent. It's his wedding night, and he's a fan, right? Like, that's what seems to be going on. Why do we got to make it sound? And honestly, don't we kind of need that message to rival all of the message of the dating shows? Look at let's just commodify them, objectify them, judge them. Don't we need a young man on his wedding night saying, oh, blown away by your beauty? It's kind of a better message. But we can answer this one away in all kinds of creative ways because the church for too long has treated people like angels. We either ignore all forms of desire, or we simply say desire is bad, don't do it. And I'll just state the obvious, how is it working? I just don't think that message is working. We tend to answer this book in one of three ways. It's either repress or the desire in one of three ways. It's repress, oppress, or suppress, right? Repress is just push it back. Suppress is like push against, or oppress is like push against it, and suppress is like push it down. Whatever you're feeling, push against, push down, or push back on those feelings and act more like an angel. And that is just not the message of this book, as you're going to see. There's really two major themes that have come back again and again and again. Number one, desire is good. It is beautiful and it is sacred. And number two, therefore, because it is good, beautiful, and sacred, God asks people to handle it really carefully. Not because it's bad, wrong, sinful, because it's really good, beautiful, and there's some parameters we would need around it. Now, this book comes rushing in with all of its humanity. It begins with her saying, let me kiss him, take me away with you, let us hurry. It begins with physical attraction. Let's just name that. It starts there. She starts with, I want to kiss him. She's attracted to him. And I know that like we, many of us grew up with a message that any sexual attraction at all is to be denied. It is to be denied. Good Christians aren't supposed to think that way. Good Christians are supposed to be, women, you are supposed to be attracted to his spiritual life and his prayer life, not his abs. So that's the message we've been given. And that's the only thing you should, like, that's it. That's it. The Bible just says, starts with the opposite in the story. It's, she's attracted to him. Now, that is true. And by the way, the Bible begins there too. Remember how Adam, when he sees Eve, first responds? It's like this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Like in Hebrew, it literally reads hubba hubba. Like that's literally, like he's a fan. He's a fan. Like he sees it and he says, thank you, God. This is what I'm looking for this whole time. This is what we're looking for. It begins with attraction. That's not to be ignored or denied or to pretend, like mentally pretend it's not there. It's, you are not an angel. But at the same time, you are not an animal. There's a line that keeps coming up inside of this song. And the line, it comes up multiple times. It's, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires, until it's ready, until it can handle it. Because we are not just flesh. We are not just spirit. They work together. And what we do with our bodies has implications on our soul. It hurts in a unique way. And we'll talk about that. So I hope this is a helpful series. If you're single, I hope it's helpful. If you're dating, if you're married. We wanted to help the conversation go deeper, so we put together a devotional. Unfortunately, it got locked down at the printers over the holiday, and so it is coming next week. Devotional coming next week. But our hope with the devotional is to give some questions to actually take this home. We created a groups guide in our devotional, a singles guide for those of you who are single, some questions to maybe help sift through the hard, complicated world of being single. And then for those of you who are dating, we recognize that, especially those who have been dating for a while, there's some questions to really help sift through that, a journal guide for personal reflection. And then for those who have been married, our hope is to give you a tool to help those marriages go even deeper. So next week, we'll have that for you. And then before I wrap up, this is a series that I would love your help on in a different way. I'll be honest with you, I feel really inadequate to talk about a lot of this. To be the one with the microphone on his chin, I feel really inadequate in this particular series because some of the stuff the song is going to go into is just stuff that is some of our deepest pain and our deepest shame. And I recognize how I just either don't have that experience or I don't have the right words for it. And so my request of you is if you have gone through any level of addiction, porn addiction, a broken marriage, a broken and restored marriage, an eating disorder, any kind of pain around this, we would love your help in the series. If those stories do surface, I just know I'm not going to be the best pastor to those of you who are in it. I can only speak from my experience. And my experience, by the way, I'm a dad, right? So like I look at this book now through the eyes of a dad with a young man and two young women, little girls actually, in my life. And so I will just warn you, I'm a dad, so if I come overly hard on, like down hard on those of you who are young dudes, I got little girls, right? Like I get that, and I just name that on the front end that I look at this book through my own eyes, and my own eyes are the eyes of a dad, and I just want us to do better. I want us as Christians to reclaim our humanity in a better way. And then my biggest request is, and this is one that we talked about, like we just pull the plug on this if we don't think we can do this. This conversation has the opportunity to present the deepest forms of shame in us, like the deepest forms of shame. And if we cannot be a shame-free church where we can be honest and vulnerable without the risk of somebody else talking about us or judging us or even seeing us different, because we all carry these wounds, all of us, then let's all of us commit to just dealing with the speck or dealing with the plank in our own eye before trying to critique the speck in each other's eyes. 20 years ago, I was a college pastor, and I had this lady set up in a meeting, and she wanted to talk, a college girl, and I sit down with her, and she started to tell me that when she was in high school, this is the 90s, she was in high school, and she said, I had a youth pastor, and he said that if you have sex before marriage, it is like being used chewing gum. You lost all your flavor. And then she said, he then took out a soda can, and he opened the soda can and said, if you open the soda can, it loses all of its fizz and its flavor. And she said, and then me and my boyfriend did, it happened, and I can't get his voice out of my head. I feel like I'm a used, worthless soda, and I feel like I'm chewed up gum, and who will want me? And then she said, worst thing is we had this group roll through our church, and they were handing out these rings, these purity rings, and I said yes, and I put the ring on my finger, and I'm now stuck, because if I leave the ring on my finger, I'm a liar. But if I take the ring off of my finger, you know what they're gonna say about me. We did that to her, the church, like the bigger church. We put her in an impossible situation where she felt as though she was too far from the grace of God. She was too far removed. And we have to do better if we're gonna have this series. I just know that marriages are hurting, and we want to actually, in order to expel the darkness, we have to open it to the light. And in order to open it to the light, it requires vulnerability. And vulnerability, if not treated really carefully, can lead to shame. And what is shame in a church? It's, can I be my honest, actual self and receive the healing I need from our Lord Jesus in a way that's safe? Or do I gotta wear a front? So we're gonna talk about a lot over the next 12 weeks. I hope it's helpful. I believe it will be. But my biggest prayer in this is that God would give us the restoration of joy, whether that's somebody who's single or dating or married, and that we would become the kind of church that reflects back to the world just what God can do with some broken people if we let him. Would you join me in a word of prayer? Lord, we acknowledge that the depth of the pain we all feel, just the unease of even talking about this, Lord, there's something in there for each of us that is like, ooh, I hope he doesn't say this. I hope we don't say that. Lord, would you help us to trust you with all of it, even if people can't trust me, Lord, would we trust you with our hearts, our prayers for that? And Jesus, we need you to remind us that there's nothing we can do. There's nothing we can do that would make us use chewing gum or worthless soda. Lord, there's nothing. You can restore all things. And Lord, we also recognize that we, you're a father. You look at us as your kids and you want to protect us. Help us to hold both those as truth. Jesus, we pray this in your name. And everybody said.
For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church and the Harbor Churches, we want to wish you a blessed week.